Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome for another episode. Today, we're recording episode 158, if I'm getting the count correctly. And I have the distinct pleasure and the honor to have with me Cherian Koshy. And Cherian joins me from Des Moines, Iowa. And we were comparing how cold it is because I am in Canada on the East Coast, in close to Halifax, and he is in Des Moines, Iowa, which is not far in terms of temperature. We're pretty much on the same wavelength here when it comes to cold temperature up north. Welcome to the show, Cherian.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate you taking the time with me today. We are going to be covering, for the audience, we are going to be covering a very interesting topic, which is, Cherian's got a lot of credential in the area. He's an author, he's a speaker, covering the topics of narrow giving in the science and donor decision-making. The focus area today, we'll be talking about the link between generosity, neuroscience, behavioral economics. It's going to get a little heavy on the behavioral science side, and I'm sure there's a lot of audience who's interested in that. I really want to dig into the fact because, you know, we're all human at the end of the day. We all feel good when we do something good. I'm talking about the majority of a human who feels that way. I want to say the vast majority of people, obviously there are exceptions to every rule, feels that they are doing something good and they feel happy about it. And that is where the conversation is going to start today. Before we get going on this conversation, Cherian, the first question that everybody gets on this channel, everybody's got a story. So What is your story? What got you here?
Well, like many of the people that you talked to on the podcast, my parents immigrated from India in the 1970s. And so they decided to immigrate to Minnesota, which is very strange for someone to come from a very warm climate to a very cold climate. And as I was just saying to you before we started recording, we like to consider that Winnipeg South. And I have a lot of family in Canada, so we would travel to Canada quite a bit and continue to do so. I have some relatives now that live in Ottawa. But we lived in Minnesota, and as immigrants, my parents were trying to figure out how to integrate into American society, how to figure out what it meant to live in a different community, learn the language, all of that. And so as immigrants, and I know this from your story as well, trying to figure out what that looks like and feels like is a challenge all of its own. And so for me, I always sort of felt a bit out of place, trying to figure out what education looks like, what jobs look like. I actually ended up not knowing exactly what I was going to do, but someone said, you know, you might be good at this particular role. It ended up being in fundraising. And so I tried it, and it was something that I was remotely good at. I was okay with it. And it turned out to be something that I pursued, but I didn't really necessarily know why I was good at it. It was something that I happened to be good at for a moment. And then I tried to do some more trial and error work in that space. And what I quickly discovered was that some of the things that were successful weren't always successful. And I imagine that there are folks that did this in like sales, where they might have been initially successful in sales, but the same things didn't always work. And so I tried learning more about the profession, tried to go to conferences, read books and whatnot. And then I sort of assumed that it was user error when the same things wouldn't work. And I got lots of certifications. I got more into professional development to figure out what was going wrong, what wasn't I doing. And that got me into behavioral science, into neuroscience, which started to explain why people made decisions on a deeper level, not just generosity decisions, but just decisions in general. That really started to speak to me, and it got me on this track of people make decisions for a very different reason, and explained a lot of what I was seeing, a lot of what I was experiencing. So I started sharing that with others and sharing the research with others. And people kept asking me, you know, where is that study? Where is that research from? And I started putting that together. And that's ultimately what the book is the, you know, collaboration and, of all of that research put together in one place, basically 220 some peer-reviewed research studies around what the neuroscience and behavioral science says about generosity. But my hope is that people take that and understand more about the human psychology of why people make the decisions they do in a kind of more general sense.
Absolutely. And you know what? Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the channel. I've been waiting for you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This is a great conversation. And to the audience, this, you know, don't confuse things, okay? This is not a nonprofit episode, okay? We're gonna be talking a lot about how the link with technology, how AI is gonna come to play, and how all this is gonna work together at the end of the day. And so the theme that we're trying to address today is why generosity is biological, or anything we do for that essence is biological. And when you come down to it, and we're all made out of molecules at the end of the day. And why organizations, in some cases, suppress it, and what leaders can do. And we talk a lot about what leaders can do on many aspects. Today, we're going to be talking about it in a nonprofit sense and doing something good for the rest of us can do about it to actually influence it in a positive way. Now, Shirian, you said, you know, your work is, I think it's at the intersection of neuroscience and neuroscience, generosity and system design, etc. So you bring in all this together from a software perspective and your studies in the neuroscience kind of thing. Most leaders think that generosity is emotional or optional. You argue that it is biological. And let's start with that. What are we missing?
Yeah. So, I mean, the science all points to the fact that it is actually biological. There are studies that indicate that pre-linguistic babies, so babies that are incapable yet of language, when they put them into an environment where they have the opportunity to be empathetic or altruistic or generous and sharing, they, in general, exhibit those behaviors. So they'll wake a baby up from a nap and they're hungry and they're cranky, and the adult will drop a snack or a toy or something like that. And the baby, who hasn't really been socialized before, will take the snack and they'll give it to the adult, or they'll take the toy and give it to the adult. And they've done this over multiple iterations, meta studies, and it demonstrates this across different cultures, across different, that amongst a bunch of different studies indicates that there's an element of our biology that does that. But then brain studies indicate that there are molecules in our brains, just like you mentioned, of oxytocin and serotonin that light up in our brain when generosity occurs. And I don't just mean, you know, that, you know, this isn't, as you mentioned, about giving to a nonprofit. There are all kinds of elements about generosity that exist and occur when we do things for other people. So as a leader, when we act generously to our staff, to our teams, that demonstrates and creates a level of trust amongst our team that creates a safe working environment, that psychological safety that's necessary for our teams to do their best work. And as a leader, we feel that and we engage in that biology occurs, those chemicals occur in our brains, but they actually also occur in the part of the other person. And we can see that through brain scans as well. So there's very clear, very proven evidence in the science around the biology of generosity, to the point where Dr. Paul Zak, for example, will give people money and say, you can either spend this on yourself or you can spend this on others. And people at the end of the day will say, you know, we spent this on ourselves, we spent this on others. The people who spent it on others come back and say they feel healthier, they feel happier. You know, they've done longitudinal studies that say that it impacted their stress levels, their cortisol levels, that it's essentially the same as like giving up smoking. Now, I want to be clear that if you are smoking, you should give up smoking. Like, that's better. But there's an effect that is significantly impacting your health when you do generous behaviors. So, and that's right down the line of the science. So you can do that research and find that this is a public health, this is a public health and a personal health impact that's really, really significant, not just, again, from a giving to a nonprofit. You should do that if you're a charitable person. And I would argue that, you know, there's benefits to doing that beyond your health. But as a person, as a leader, as a someone who cares, that has a really significant benefit to you as well.
So did I hear in your text here that there is something, it sounds like there is an emotional propagation of positivity that goes across, not just in the brain that is the individual doing the giving, but on the receiving side?
Yes.
And if that individual being an individual, a group of individuals, so I'm assuming there's a bit of a wave that transcends across whoever getting impacted by all this. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. There's a few ways that that happens, but the very simple way of describing that is a concept called mirror neurons. So if you've ever seen someone or experienced someone yawning, and then you yawn at the same time.
True. Yeah, I do that.
Yeah, and that's a concept based in mirror neurons. So when we see someone yawn and we yawn, there's these neurons in our brains that mimic other people. And it's that same biology that occurs. And so when we experience someone suffering, our brains actually feel that suffering with them. And when we experience or see someone acting generously or doing something nice, we feel that with them. And so that same biology, that same psychology works in the same way. And so there's a lot of science around that concept. So there's much more to that. There's more that can be unpacked, but on a very simple level, the mirror neuron concept drives a lot of that.
And you know, when somebody gives, and it's such an admirable thing to give anything, time, emotion, support, whatever you give it. So the question becomes, if such a positive thing that gets transformed in our brain and our human body, soul, etc., whatever you want to call it, why don't people do it then? Is there like a negative side to this where there's like a firewall between the positive and the negative, like sort of like angels and devils doing the fight up there, or what's going on?
Absolutely. I mean, so let's talk about this from a much broader perspective, and then we can talk about it, you know, if we want, from a charitable giving perspective. I think it all comes back to kind of a scarcity perspective in our daily lives. And most people that are successful will tell you that the best way to be successful is to give it away. To give it away when it comes to knowledge. And when you think about your workplace, for example, the negative aspect of not being generous is that you actually end up working at cross purposes. So there's an article that I've written that's coming out in Forbes shortly that talks about essentially negative work. And what I mean by that is, in a workplace culture where coworkers are not generous, meaning they don't share what they know and what they're working on, and they operate from silos, or they don't share what they know and how what they're working on, you actually end up not telling someone that you are doing something that could help them. And because of that, someone might be working on something that they don't need to be working on. And as a result, the work that you're doing is not only unnecessary, it's work that undermines the work of someone else. It's negative work. And this is what ultimately causes burnout and frustration in our workplaces. Because my work is not just unfulfilling from a generic perspective, it's work that absolutely did not need to be done. It's work that did not accomplish anything because somebody else did it, and I didn't even know that it was done. That's so frustrating to go to work and know that I didn't even need to show up for that 8-10 hours a day because it just absolutely was useless work. And that has everything to do with the culture of the workplace, because someone had this fiefdom of, I needed to protect what I produced. But a culture of generosity in the workplace eliminates that, to say, no, we're all in this together. Here's what I'm working on. Where can you contribute? Where can I contribute to make the best work product possible so that we can all accomplish this goal? And a good leader encourages that and says, let's share this information. Let's share what we're working on so that we can create the best possible work. The same thing is then true in our communities, in our culture, to say, we all want a better place to live. We all want a better future for our communities. And this scarcity mentality of, this is the only thing that we have and we need to protect our little part of what we have, it infiltrates everything that we think about. And if we lose this part, then we've lost what we have, and then we will never get that back. I also think, I used to coach and work in academic debate. I used to coach one of the like world's debate team. We competed against the Canadian team quite a bit as well. And this works in argumentation as well, in public policy debates. And what we often talked about in argumentation is the idea of viewing other people's arguments charitably. And what I mean by that is when we look at someone else's policy arguments or just the discussions that are happening in the public space with essentially a charitable mindset, that you are making the best argument about and coming from it with the best of intentions, we engage on a different level with other people, as opposed to saying, we want to defeat you as a person, and we want to approach this as this antagonistic approach because you are wrong and I need to be right from a zero-sum perspective, and there's nothing that you say that can be right. And the way to approach, in my perspective, the way to approach this is to say, there's something true about what you're saying. There's something that we can approach charitably about your view of the world that we can both agree upon. And if we collaborate on this, then we can find whatever the best solution is that's neither fully mine nor fully yours, but will ultimately better everyone.
Absolutely. And you know, when I really love that logic, you don't need to be right all the time. They don't need to be wrong all the time.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's validity of there's a delta of intersection between what's positive between the two opinions. And you're right. Like I've seen those debates when, you know, even TV debates nowadays, we all live in a highly charged political environment. You go into watch some of these debates, it's just like makes you frustrating. Frustrated because you don't, you know, there are good ideas on both sides, but because the other side said it, it's wrong automatically.
Yes. And there's no quarter given, right? And the reality is that there, and I know that this is not going to come across acceptable to most people, but I will say this from my perspective. There are things somewhere, my debate coach used to say that there's truth in every, at some point, there's truth in every position. There's something that is true on every side. You have to find that truth. Like it could be hidden, but there's something there that everyone can believe in. And if we dig down deep enough, there's something that we can agree upon. And we've gotten to a point in our world today where we've masked that. We've lost track of that. And I think that's to our detriment. We've gotten to a point where everything's polarized and there's a person on the other side who deeply cares about the thing that they care about. And that's not to be disregarded, right? Like they're a person who wants the best for themselves, for their family, for their future. And we're not going to get anywhere by just saying like nothing about them is right, is viable. And there's no way that our world can function if everybody just goes to their corner and kind of lives over there. I just don't see a way in which that works. So we have to approach this. Like my view is we have to approach the world from a perspective of generosity.
Now, you mentioned it earlier, Sherry, and the leader's impact or influence on the idea of being generous inside of a workplace, in this case, not just workplace, could be organization, could be anybody. What do you think of that? How do leaders sometimes get it wrong, or what can they do positively to influence it positively and put it in, as a lot of people, like they approach that whole generosity opposing idea of generosity is security, right? So
yeah.
I got to create my own security system by have some intellectual property that I own and nobody else owns. And therefore I created, like you said, fiefdom for myself and nobody can approach that. But if leaders encourage it in a different way, I'm assuming the giving becomes incentivized.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the key is accountability and incentive play a large role in how leaders encourage a culture of generosity in the workplace. My friend Amira Barger writes a book called The Price of Nice, and she talks about the language. And I know you talk about the language on your podcast a lot. The language that leaders use in day-to-day conversation that shapes the culture inside of the organization. And so I'd recommend that folks pick up that book in particular, because the words that we use every day shape how our teams think about what is encouraged in our spaces and what's discouraged in our spaces. So the example that Amira uses is if we start conversations by saying, let's get aligned on this, then it subtly discourages people from speaking up if they are not, if they have something that's outside of the alignment. But if we say something like, let's make sure we hear all of the voices before we get aligned. That allows free expression. So when we think about generosity, one of the things that I would encourage leaders to think about is, how do we think about recognition from a distributed perspective? How do we think about recognizing the work of everyone on our team and being generous around our recognition? One of my teachers, Francesca Gina, talks about gratitude of our coworkers, our teammates, as a very important aspect of productivity. She wrote an article about this. And as a leader myself, one of the things that is easy to forget is how important gratitude is, because we think, well, we're paying them, so that's how we're recognizing the work that they're doing. But the actual act of saying thank you and demonstrating that gratitude actually has a really significant impact on productivity. And it's a very simple thing to do, but we tend to forget it. So that's a very simple thing, but there's lots of other ways that we can be generous in the ways in which we show up as a leader.
Now, what do you think about somebody being incentivized and generosity being embedded into their personality? Can the two traits, are they in conflict? Can they coexist?
Absolutely. I think that there are ways to sort of encourage or incentivize people to be generous. I think the other thing is true that you can essentially penalize, if you will, or hold people accountable for generosity. I think sometimes people worry about generosity being exploited, but I think the key is that we need to set boundaries for what generosity is. It's not that we wouldn't want to run rampant around generosity and let it go wild, but I would encourage leaders to think about how do we measure or how do we put into our, whether they're KPIs or something like that, to incentivize our teams to form cross collaborations, to ensure communications are occurring between teammates and between departments that proactively share information, that are celebrating wins, all of these types of things that activate on the culture of generosity. And generosity is really the way in which this is the way that we do things here shows up as a cultural phenomenon. So it's not just the policy of saying these are the incentives, it's the underlying sort of substrate of the work that's being done. And I'm sure that you know this and your audience knows this. Like, when you walk into an organization and there's this like political culture on Slack or on Teams or in the hallway of people just not sharing information, or leaders that go into a room and decisions are being made and they're not necessarily communicated, like, that's the conversation, that's the type of culture that is not generous by nature. People know that immediately. And that's the dangerous component. And it spills out into how everyone treats everyone else. And then how that spills out into the way in which that company treats their customers, how it treats their vendors, how it shows up in the community, and on and on and on, right? And so what I would say is, absolutely, it's tone at the top, right? Like, the leadership carries that culture forward, and it should be incentivized and encouraged and held accountable. But it's also these little things that just can't necessarily be measured, but is shown and is just something that is a phenomenon, if that makes sense.
No, I feel like after this conversation, I'm getting a little bit of a refresh here on leadership styles. And I really, as soon as you were talking about like going into a place, leaders going into a place and making decisions, and the rest of the, the rest of the staff or the rest of the team doesn't know what's going on and they stay in the dark. I'm just imagining playing in my head. Like, I left the corporate world about a few months ago now. And I can imagine like walking in the hallway and I see like this room on the corner side of an office doors closed, everybody's huddled in, and you've got an entire staff sitting on the floor, probably thinking, you know, is there a round of layoff coming?
Right. Yeah.
We're going to hang on to our jobs for the next few weeks, or what's the story? And the anxiety that creates.
Absolutely.
It's crazy.
I mean, so obviously I do a lot of work in the nonprofit space, but I think, and I don't want to go too far off tangent, but this is the worry with artificial intelligence today, right? That when organizations are investing in technology, particularly in artificial intelligence, that trepidation accelerates the scarcity mindset because people worry about the job that they're doing. And this is not necessarily, and to be clear, I am not a Luddite by any means. I built and sold an AI company. I work for a technology company now, headquartered out of PEI. Like, you know, I love technology. Like, this is something that's important. But when organizations bring technology into their space and they start talking about it without cultivating that culture of generosity, that change management approach is jarring. Then you have this moment of people worrying, like, is this coming for my job, and or does it mean that my job is going to change so much that I'm not ready for what's going to come next? So the culture of generosity is both the you're not going to lose your job, but also you don't have to do a 180 on what skills you've learned and what you've grown to know and do something completely different. That's the world that we live in this moment that is causing so much fear and worry that leaders need to be understanding of in this moment.
So I'm going to ask you about Kindsight. First, let's talk about Kindsight for a second. I've got a couple more questions for you.
Sure.
More questions for you. Yeah. What does Kindsight do? And I've noticed, I went on their LinkedIn page a little bit, but for the audience, if you don't mind, just maybe frame Kindsight for us.
Yeah. So Kindsight provides nonprofit organizations, particularly in the US and Canada, with fundraising intelligence. So it provides organizations with the information, the data, and the analysis to be able to reach the right donors at the right time with the right message to be able to engage them with causes that they care about.
Absolutely. And how long have you been working with them, Sharon?
They acquired my company about 2 years ago, but I was a customer of theirs before that. So I feel like I've been part of the organization for about...
You became part of the deal, right?
Yeah.
You work with ethical AI, and we've been talking about ethical AI and how to deploy AI on this channel for about 157, and this is 158 episodes. So
that's great.
It's a long topic and a deep topic as well. Where does AI in your world amplify generosity, and how does it damage it if there's such thing?
Well, that's a whole additional podcast. That's a long
book. Another one.
Yeah. So, to be brief, so I'm on the advisory panel of fundraising.ai, which is the governing council of what we would say is ethical AI in the fundraising profession. And I've done some additional work with the London School of Economics, their certification in ethical AI, the ethics of AI. And what I would say is that we as a nonprofit sector feel like we have the ability to lead when it comes to ethical AI because the standards of what ethics are and responsible and beneficial use of AI is higher in the nonprofit space than it is in the commercial space because of where donor trust lands in this space. So where I would say transparency and consent around the use of AI is in the nonprofit space is at a higher level. There's higher scrutiny around donor privacy and what can be done in AI. My friend Nathan Chappelle and I are the two researchers who have done now the only study and the only longitudinal study of donor perceptions of AI. We've now done this over the last 2 years. And what we found is that donors sort of expect that nonprofit organizations are using AI, but they're also very concerned about data and privacy use, privacy concerns around AI. And so there's the organizations that don't have policies around data use and how they're engaging with their constituency. Those are the ones that are essentially falling behind. And that doesn't mean that organizations need to jump in full board in using AI for all kinds of things. But what I would say is that for most organizations, they're using it primarily for content generation, like a ChatGPT, you know, how can I write a fundraising appeal? But there's so much more that can be done from an AI perspective. Kindsight's using it for predictive analytics on, you know, who to talk to, and, you know, what to talk to them about, what are, who are the most likely to respond, summarization of data and all of those types of things. There's lots more that can be done than just, you know, write an appeal type of approach. So there's way more that can be done out there than what most people are thinking about in the space of AI.
I do host a networking event that takes place on every Friday in the morning called the AI Exchange.
A few people attend
that. It's a global event. And the topic is AI and AI-related ideas. It's just people exchanging ideas, to be honest with you. There's a lot of discussions around, obviously, the technology. But one of the biggest thing, and I would love to get your take on this, is a lot of people think today AI has got a few things going on. But one of the items is, as a system, the question is still out there. Are they neutral? Are they manipulative? And sometimes are they just simply ignorant to the human psychology, for instance?
Sure.
What's your take on that?
So what I would argue is, and again, I'm not by any means a Luddite. You know, we work as a company in AI quite a bit. And obviously, like, my entrance into this company was through an AI company that I built. What I will say, though, is that there's an assumption around AI platforms that AI is always truthful, that AI has judgment or discernment, and that AI is able to think non-linearly. So let me address those three, because AI is the worst today that we'll ever see it. And so when it comes to things around, like, the context, meaning the psychology or the ignorance, I feel like that's an area where AI can always get better. And if we provide AI with the appropriate context, it can do things that, you know, any human can do faster, better, smarter. But the issue is that AI doesn't have an objective sense of truth. It only has truth regarding the context that we provide it. AI doesn't lie in the sense of, is it manipulative? But when it's provided with an objective, so in the nonprofit space, what we worry about is, if its objective is to raise the most funds, then it will do that at the expense of sustainable donor relationships. If the objective in the for-profit sense is to sell the most goods, it will do so at the expense of customer relationships. That's my worry, and the worry of many people that agree with me. And so where we would draw the line is to say AI should be used up until the point of engaging directly with the donor or the customer, because that would put the AI in a place where it would make a decision that we would not want to entrust with the AI itself. That's my bias. Other people won't agree with that, and that's fine. But because it's not necessarily capable of quote unquote trust, that's where I would essentially draw that line. And we can't imbue it with necessarily those trust guidelines in that same way. And what I would say is truth around that component. There is still a nature of hallucination that would occur. We can get better at that. But again, that has a lot to do with the context. When it comes to decision-making, again, we can get better at that. But the decision-making component relies upon what we have told it to decide between. And if it's not come up with if it's a new issue, then it doesn't necessarily know how to decide between those issues. And that's an area where I worry about. I talk about this a lot in workshops that I do with organizations. If we don't provide it with information that someone, like, if we have to read between the lines from a conversation that someone would have, the AI is not going to know how to deal with that. And with a lot of human interaction, it is about reading between the lines on what someone is saying. And the last thing that I would say is AI always functions in linear thinking, meaning whatever has happened before, it's the next plausible action. So what humans are good at is thinking outside of the box. What is this connection that doesn't make sense in this circumstance? And so what the future looks like is outside of the box thinking. It's something that we have not predicted before. So if we are hoping for what is the next logical step, AI is great at doing that. So I use AI every day to produce something. But when I'm thinking about what is the world look like in 2030, I'm not asking AI for that answer. I might hope for a brainstorm or something like that, but that's where I'm going to rely on my own thinking and my own innovation or my own expertise.
Absolutely. You need to stay in the middle. You need to stay in control at this point of
precisely.
Any technology. Now, as you know, on this channel, we also talk a lot about languages and demographics and a variety of cultures.
Yeah.
How does a generosity changes, if it does, across cultures, in your opinion?
So the research indicates that across almost every culture, some of the core principles of generosity stay the same. And so what I include in the book, particularly around generosity, is that the biology of generosity doesn't change, and that's been studied across almost every country. So I'm proud of the fact that the book was endorsed by someone on at least 5 continents, because those principles resonate across multiple different cultures. And I tried to make sure that I wasn't just using studies from Western authors, that there were authors across different cultures that were reaffirming the principles that exist, because generosity is something that exists across different cultures and is something that plays out in a lot of different ways. So I definitely wanted to, in certain chapters, talk about how communal cultures appreciate or view generosity in different ways, and how monetary giving looks very different from giving of time or in relationship, personal relationships in particular. So are there ways that generosity expressions play out differently? Absolutely. But core concepts of generosity, reciprocity and interaction with humans, there's not a whole lot that changes there. And as you mentioned very early on in the podcast, are there exceptions to the rule? Absolutely, for sure. But generosity is one of those values that's existed since ancient times. It's one of those values that cuts across cultures in a lot of ways.
Now, if we were to, for those CEOs and owners, operators running, running companies and listening to this podcast, and they listen to our conversations herein, if a CEO, for instance, wants to redesign their organization to be more generosity aligned, where do you think they should start?
I'd honestly say that they would want to start with themselves, because I do think
self-reflection.
Yes, I think it's self-reflection first, because I do think that it is how the leader shows up every day that people look at and then model their behavior after that. And then what I would say is the language and the incentives of the leadership is how the culture of the company follows or changes their behavior. So there's an interesting book called The Tyranny of Metrics. And I quote that book in my book. It's actually about higher education. And the book is about how the incentives, actually the pernicious incentives inside of higher education, shapes the behavior of universities and colleges in a bad way. But I think that the book is widely applicable to other places, such as businesses, because ultimately the principle is that what we measure ends up becoming what matters. So for leaders, what I would say is, in your self-reflection, reflect on what are the things that you are measuring in your company? And are those things driving measurements and meaning that you don't actually want to encourage? One example of that is, I've said this multiple times to teams and inadvertently created problems that I didn't mean to create. The statement that I've made is, I don't want to hear a problem without a solution. I felt like that was a way of encouraging my team to be solutions oriented. What I inadvertently did was silence people from raising issues inside of the team and quieting them to indicating that there was something wrong that either they had done or that they saw that was wrong in our operations. What I should have done was to create an environment of psychological safety, to say, you're safe here. Everyone makes mistakes. To be the generous leader to say, I've made mistakes. We all make mistakes. Even if you don't have a solution, We will all work together to come up with a solution. Come to me with your problems. Come share them. We will figure it out together. That's an example of where a simple thing that I had said, or maybe something that I had incentivized, created a problem that I didn't intend to create. And every leader that's listening to this, every manager, every team member may be doing something differently that creates a world that they didn't intend to create. And I think that's how language influences behavior. And you talk about this a lot in your podcast, which I appreciate so much. But I think that's the reflection that everyone needs to really think about, maybe just for a few minutes right after this podcast and after some of the other episodes from your podcast. Just think for a few minutes about, what does my language create in the world that maybe I'm not exactly intending for that to be the world that they inhabit?
Examine the steps that you've taken already. Examine the steps that you're going to be taking in the future after this conversation.
Precisely.
Which is great advice. Now, in your opinion, can or is generosity a competitive advantage or liability in modern business? What do you think?
I think it's absolutely a competitive advantage. I think
is there metrics on that somewhere?
There's absolutely metrics on how it impacts. I mean, the Francesca Gino article around gratitude very much points to productivity. So that's one point that's very clearly driving towards a competitive advantage. That science is there. I think the application that I'm making around the word generosity is not necessarily as direct, but I do think that there's a lot of evidence around leaders who are sacrificial in their approach, or leaders who create trust and psychological safety and all of those things. So the application is absolutely there in competitive advantage. I'm using the word generosity because I think it encompasses many of these traits in a larger cultural phenomenon. So I would argue that generosity in a greater sense does create a competitive advantage when you put all of these pieces together, because I think it encompasses a larger phenomenon than just one piece of a trusting environment or psychological safety environment or a gratitude environment. It's a bigger concept of saying a leader and a culture that is generous to one another does much more that drives towards productivity and collaboration and spirit of working together that allows people to do their best work and to show up in their best way.
Now, I know you went through a book writing process, and in your world, that takes a lot of research and discussions, dialogues, references, etc. When you were going through the process, Sharon, what surprised you the most of writing Neurogiven? For the audience, just a reminder that Sharon Koshy wrote a book called Neurogiven.
So particularly a book like this, which was very research-driven. So I mentioned 220 plus peer-reviewed source citations. This is a very research-heavy book on purpose. So I'm grateful for Wiley and the team of editors that helped me go through that with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that everything was cited properly and to make sure everything makes sense and all of that. I think the thing that helped me the most and surprised me the most was the process of putting it all together, but also just understanding the depth of how much research was out there. The first draft was 90,000 words and the final product was a little over 60,000 words. So there's a lot more out there that didn't make the final product. So there's much more that could be said is what I would say.
And if somebody wants to pick up the book, Amazon, I'm assuming?
Yeah, anywhere great books are sold. So Indigo, Amazon, anywhere that you like to buy books.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I sort of see here after 158 episodes is there's a lot of owners, CEOs, operators, they come on the podcast. And I'm always, you know, intrigued and surprised by things that they probably did not talk about, or things they shouldn't have talked about, but they did talk about. Just, you know, as we come to an end here, I still have a couple more questions for you. In your world, what questions do you wish leaders would ask you, but they never do?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the question that leaders probably never ask is around what are maybe the truly tactical ways that generosity shows up. How do we know that generosity is showing up in a workplace? How can we tell that it's showing up in a workplace? So there's definitely ways that we can, you know, as we talked about, how we can incentivize it. How do we know that it's working? And I guess what I would say is that we know that it's working partly by the outcome, right? But I also think that we know that it's working when the leader doesn't need to be there to encourage those conversations, that you can step away from that level of conversation and people are doing it on their own, that your teams are out there sharing information or working together without you necessarily facilitating it. That's one evidence of generosity occurring. That's sort of like a self-sustaining kind of model of it. But I think there's other ways of thinking about it as well.
Absolutely. Now, my last question, if you could leave the audience with one uncomfortable truth, uncomfortable, it has to be uncomfortable, what would it be?
I would leave people with the truth that you are exactly as generous as you want to be, and that is probably not as generous as you could be.
Be better. We can always improve.
I think that's the case. And I say that of myself as well.
Absolutely. And if we're not learning and improving on a daily basis, why do we even exist? Shireen, I want to, you know, before we wrap it up here, I just want to leave a few minutes for you to close it off for us. What do you think of the episode? How did the conversation go? What do you hope to for the audience to do here?
I think this is fantastic. And it's one of the best conversations I've had about kind of the application to a broader context. It's really the first time that I've talked about generosity playing out in culture and community, which I'm really grateful for. That's really honestly very near and dear to my heart. So I'm glad that we got to talk about that. So I'm really hopeful that whether people buy this book, because I know it's not a nonprofit audience. So, I mean, if people buy it for their favorite nonprofit, I won't complain about that. But whether they buy it for themselves or for a cause that they care about, that's great. What I would love for the audience to consider is how can they implement this in their personal lives, being generous to family members and friends in conversation, in relationships? How can they implement this in their workforce, in their companies? What does it mean to do that self-reflection in the next few minutes after this podcast is over, to maybe review some of your other podcast episodes and to go back and do that self-reflection? Think about what are those language choices? What does that mean for them to show up at work differently based upon what we've talked about and what maybe some of your other guests have talked about? And what does that spillover look like into their communities in conversations with maybe someone that they don't agree with? How does that play out into the larger space that we inhabit? Because frankly, I do believe that this is a concept that could impact our world in a different, better way. I think we could show up differently to conversations that make us better people, better neighbors, and make for a better society.
Absolutely. And Shireen, I want to thank you for all this. And that's really, you know, the conversation that I've had with you today is one of the rarest conversation I've had on this podcast. I always love to dive into the human aspect and the chemistry behind it. And you really articulated it very understandably. You know, everybody in our audience community from various levels of education can really grasp it, understand it, action it, and take it to the next level. I really appreciate your time with me today.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Shireen. And for the audience, I want to thank you thank you for listening in. If you're coming in on a podcast, I really appreciate it. We're approaching 70,000 downloads in the past 60 days. We're averaging about 1,500 downloads per day per now for you for the podcast. And if you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching. And please, when I publish these things when I publish these podcasts on YouTube, I do publish the long form of the conversation, which is the entire discussion. And I also publish close to about 25 short videos where we highlight key moments of the podcast. So please feel free to check those out as well. And I'll also put a blog post where we summarize the conversation. You can check out the blog post on robinayoub.blog. And that's my blog post where you can, you know, reference other podcasts that we've done in the past. And you can see, you don't have to listen to 1 hour discussion if you don't want to. Feel free to do that. But if you want to get the Cole's Note version of the discussion, that's where you can find them. Again, from me and my guest of honor today, Shireen Koshy, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it, and I'll see you next time.